subtle little glimmer, some suggestion that you'd have me if I could only make me better, then I would stand a little stronger as I walk a little taller all the time. Because I know you are a cynic, but I think I can convince you that, 'cause broken people can get better if they really want to, or at least that's what I have to tell myself if I am hoping to.
Good afternoon, Vancouver. Hello, Vancouver. This is Giuseppe and Darren G. Hi, Darren.
What's happening?
What's happening? We're in studio live from the downtown east side of Vancouver.
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are. And this is Talk Recovery Radio, coming to you live every Thursday, noon to 1 on 100.5 FM. And it's a horrible rainy day outside in Vancouver, and I'm driving in and there's the homeless camp, you know, in the Pigeon Park, and everything's all wet and someone's shooting heroin right in front of the car. Oh, I forgot to pay for parking. I gotta do that. I get so many tickets here. So yeah, the person shooting heroin just kind of distracted me from paying for my parking. Damn it, I'm gonna give him my ticket if I get one. Think he'll pay it? Probably not.
No,
I don't think so. So we come to you live. We try to bring different issues. We have guests from around the world on our show every week, and then we follow it up with a personal story, which ends up on Facebook Live. You know, last week's we had Ashley in, and what a great personal story that was. She did a magnificent job reminding people that women can recover. And today we've got some great conversations taking place as well. You know, I just want to talk to Darren really quickly. And another wonderful article posted on the BC Center on Substance Use's Facebook page. There's something about this article, though, that, you know, it's, you know, we don't want the recovery community to feel, you know, that they're not, you know, valued in our stakeholder meetings, but we just don't like the word addict and sober and clean. So professionals, you know, the professional world needs to stop using. But if you guys want to call yourselves addicts, that's okay. Like, that's how it was like 2-3 years ago. So I'm reading this article and it literally says no one, including the general public, should use the word addict, alcoholic, or clean. And I'm just like, what is wrong with these people? Like, this is my, I won't say his name, but my friend is their social media person, right? And like, I know him. I just feel like posting on there, like, what is your problem? Like, what is wrong with you? Like, I've had so many canapes with you at stupid receptions where we're sitting there talking about, you know, recovery, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, over, you know, horrible rubber chicken, and then you post articles like this. It's so disappointing.
Let's get him in for an interview.
I should get him in for an interview. It's just,
so what's the problem?
Well, people aren't. Here's the problem. They're saying that people aren't seeking help because they feel stigmatized being associated as an addict or an alcoholic. But,
well, what are they then?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. What are you? I don't know. I was pretty annoyed when I got told I was a diabetic.
I mean, I take a little bit of a different stance than you, Giuseppe, on the identification.
Yeah.
I think we both agree that it's a personal choice.
Exactly.
How to identify yourself in what public forum.
Just like being gay. Like, don't tell me who I am. I am who I am.
That's right. But I'm, like, here's my discrepancies when it comes to public forums. If I label myself an addict in a general forum of public people that don't understand that I'm coming from a 12-step group, that it's very important to identify as an addict, present tense, even though I'm not an addict anymore, or I'm not using drugs, or I'm not addicted to drugs, and there could be some confusion. The only reason I call myself an addict is because I come from NA.
You know, I'm going to make it really simple. I think this is a heterosexual problem, because when I was young, I said the same thing about the word queer. If I told somebody I was gay, the first thing they thought of was me, sex.
Yeah.
Oh, you have sex with guys. Today, that's changed. It's like that's not the first thing.
It's different. If I label myself an addict to somebody who's wondering, let's say, why I don't drink, because I'm an addict, I'm going to say, like, I'm a person in recovery.
But here's the scary part of this. If you read this article, it says no one should use the word. It doesn't say what you're saying.
Yeah, that's black and white.
It says no one. No one. Like, that's pretty clear. No one should use. So, like, let's just forget about AA. Let's just forget about NA. Let's just forget about the millions of recovering addicts and alcoholics. Their stories don't matter.
Yeah.
Let's just worry about your story. You feel a little stigmatized. And here's the other problem with this. And then we're going to go to our guests because we're running into the second part of the show. There's research out there that shows the number one reason people don't go into recovery, it's not stigma. The number one reason is denial. And they know that.
And
the
shame.
BCCSU knows. No, not shame. Denial. Denial is the number one reason. They ask Canadians across the country. They deny that they even have a problem. And the BCCSU knows that. CCSA knows that. The Fraser Health. Everybody knows that. But you never see anti-denial campaigns. You only see anti-stigma campaigns. And there's a reason. Because the minute you start saying denial is the number one reason, it just shows that, you know, there's choice and there's people. And, you know, it's the person using. It's their situation. It's not society's fault that someone's using. And anyway, we're at 12:08. We come to you live every Thursday. If you agree with us, awesome. If you don't agree with us, awesome. But that's what we talk about, all different issues. And today we are talking to Sarah Hepola. And we've got Sarah on the phone. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay. Hi, Sarah. Sarah is the author of, I love this title, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. That is, like, we have interviewed over 6 years of many authors, and that is like top 10 names of books. So congratulations on that. Awesome job, Sarah. So
thanks,
Sarah,
guys.
Yeah, welcome to Talk Recovery. You know, we try to have a lot of fun. We're live on the radio right now on 100.5 FM, and we're interested in your story and so forth. So what was it like to finally sit down and say, hey, I'm going to tell the world my story? What was that like for you? And
well, I should point out that I've been doing that for a long time. I was a writer as a living. I had been telling stories about my life since I was about 20 years old, and I was writing for an alternative paper in Austin, Texas. So that was kind of what I did. My mom was a therapist, and I learned from a young age that talking about yourself was okay, and then I think I probably got a lot of attention for it, and I was good at it, so I kept doing it. But what changed, you know, when I was in my 20s and my early 30s, a lot of my stories were like, I drink a lot, isn't that funny? You know, I used it as comedy fodder. I think a lot of us do that.
Yes.
And because I was so blunt about it, because I was so upfront about it, people were really like taken aback. They were like, oh, okay, I guess it is funny that you drink too much. You're a delight. You're a firecracker.
So and are you one of the, like, the real cool girls that drank and had martinis and, like, everybody kind of hung out with you, and then one day, like, hey, what happened to Sarah? She doesn't drink anymore.
I mean, I certainly wanted to be a cool girl. I don't know that I really was. I think a lot of people that want that figure, that persona, they want it so badly because they feel deeply uncool, and I always did. And I think I always felt like an outsider, and I always felt like an observer, and that's how I became a writer. And drinking brought me into the center of the party. But I struggled with drinking. My drinking really went off the rails in college. That's when I realized that I drank differently than other people, because I would have these really long blackouts, and I wouldn't know what happened. And blackouts are like when, I mean, probably everyone on Recovery Radio knows what they are, but I always have to make a point.
Yeah, what is a blackout to you? Yeah, what is a blackout?
So they're periods of amnesia. They're temporary amnesia brought on by drinking too much. And like in the normal world, a lot of people think blackouts are passing out, but blackouts are like you're still talking and interacting with people, but you can't remember it the next day. So I would have these like hours long periods of blackouts. And the next day I wouldn't know what I did, and my friends would have to tell me, and oftentimes my behavior was really weird. So, like, that was never cool. Like, nobody thought that was super cool, like when Sarah goes into blackout mode.
So when you would come out of a blackout, did you have that moment of, like, I'm never going to do that again? Did you have that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then you just did it again, eh?
And it did, you know, I would be like, okay, well, I guess I have to stop drinking, but if you try to stop drinking in college, it's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah,
I
want to talk about that for a second. So there's this difference between, I mean, there just is. There's a difference between men and women when it comes to drinking. You know, I had my drinking scene and all that kind of stuff. What was it like for you as a woman growing up in college drinking? What was it like? Were you forced to drink? Did you have to drink?
Absolutely not. No, I loved drinking very much and from a very young age. And I don't know how representative I am of women, because there's a lot of women that make themselves drink in order to get along with the crowd. I was thrilled that I was going to be able to drink. I had been sneaking beer since I was like 6 or 7 because I loved the taste of it. And I had learned very early that it fixed me in some fundamental way. And so when I got to college and people were drinking with abandon, I was like, I've arrived. I've found my place. Yeah. And I'm a very small person. I'm about 5'2". I'm, you know, not very good at sports, and the fact that I could drink a beer faster than a 6'2" guy, I felt like awesome.
I love that part about the I arrived. Like, I had that I arrived moment. Yeah. I grew up in Ontario. Now I'm in BC, but I'm very close to Detroit. And I walked into my first Detroit gay bar when I was 16. And there was 1,000 people on drugs and booze. And I was like, I arrived. And I, like, I just felt like I was home, right? And probably, you know, I'm surprised I survived it all, but I did.
I think I'd always wanted a bigger life than the one I had been given. And so when I got to college and later in my 20s, when I became a journalist, alcohol was how I got access to that feeling of having a big, exciting, grand life.
So what happened then? So you're drinking, you're doing blackouts, family get involved? Did they say, hey, you got a problem? Work get involved? Hey,
no.
You got a problem?
No, not at all.
None of that.
Because first of all, I was really good at remaining functional. I mean, I think my biggest fear from the time that I was 20 and I started blacking out was, oh, if I get too bad, I'm going to have to stop. So I tried really hard to keep it under control. And I became a journalist. And in my profession, drinking heavy is often excused and sometimes encouraged. And so I would come to work and be like, oh, I had this horrible blackout last night. And they'd be like, that's hilarious.
Is it like, you know, come be part of the boys, just like come drink with us? Is there that kind of attitude?
Yeah, I don't think it was boys specifically. To me, it was very gender non-specific. It was like I was coming of age in the 90s and the aughts in Austin, Texas, and I never had this sense that boys drink and women don't. I never had that sense.
Okay.
I had this sense that cool people drink and uncool people don't. Was very much the way that
I was like, you don't do drugs? Like, what's wrong with you? Like, everybody does. Anybody that's cool does drugs and booze. So the book, is the book about alcohol? Like, what is the book about?
And the book is about falling in love with alcohol, and then why do you have to give it up? You know, it's trying for me to understand the question of why I had to drink as much as I did and why I had to walk away from it. First of all, nobody had written a book about blackouts in particular, because we didn't really understand the neuroscience of it until this century, which is sort of crazy when you think about it.
What is the neuroscience? I'd like to know that too. And I'm sure you explain it in your book, maybe just a snippet for our listeners.
Sure. I mean, the point is that what happens in a blackout is that the hippocampus shuts down, and the hippocampus is the part of the brain that's involved in storing long-term memories. So it just becomes disabled. And there are two different forms of blackout. There's a fragmentary and then an en bloc, ENBLOC. So fragmentary is like that flickering thing where you remember like parts of the night but not all of it. And then the en bloc are the big swaths of time. And nobody really knows why people have blackouts. They seem to be genetically linked. But about 50% of drinkers do have them. It is not specific to alcoholics. alcoholics do have them more often because we drink more often. But, oh, I know we're not supposed to use that term. But anyway, problem drinkers, however you want to classify it.
Would you consider yourself an alcoholic, or is that something you don't like
to share? I did finally come. What I learned was that I can't drink like other people. And so the term that I hung on that was alcoholism. But it's a tricky little word, right? Because you can spend a long time in a spin cycle of, like, what is alcoholism? Why is it, you know, do I have it? Can I get over it? What does it mean? And part of the reason why it's so stigmatized is because for the 75 years that Alcoholics Anonymous has been around, there was half that word anonymous that meant, I mean, half the phrase, the name, that meant that people didn't come out to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so you had this idea that alcoholics were people that were shivering under the overpass, you know, that had lost everything. And you didn't understand that alcoholics were governors and people on Supreme Court and rock stars. I mean, they were all sorts of people around you. They were nurses and firemen. I mean, people, now these are people in recovery, but they also identify as people that have alcoholism. But the truth is that nobody really understands exactly what this is. It seems to be a combination of genetics and culture. You know, it's you got a certain thing through birth, and then you laid a certain set of behaviors on that, and the combination of them resulted in you not being able to drink like other people. And for most of us, we drink really well for a long time, and then it quits working.
Yeah, I come from a place, I went to treatment and all that kind of stuff, but our recovery is more or less, you know, let's just focus on the solution. Like, okay, you're going to figure out why you can't drink. Then what? You know what I mean? It's like, okay, then what? And it looks like for you, your recovery process is sharing your information with other people and bringing this conversation about blackouts out into the open. And I really believe the more we talk about everything, whether or not we agree to it or not, just something good will always come out of dialogue. We just need to talk more about it. So did your life... There's a turning point at some point before the book even gets, you know, into the picture. So that turning point, what was that turning point for you that got you to say, hey, enough is enough?
Yeah, I was 35 years old. And I think from the point that I was 20 and first experienced a blackout to 35 years old, it was basically a long 15-year period of kind of being in denial, like you guys were talking about before. I knew that I had to quit, but I didn't want to. I really couldn't stomach the idea of a life without alcohol. It just seemed so completely unfathomable to me. And I thought that nobody would want to hang out with me. And I wouldn't be funny, and I wouldn't be fun to be around. Finally, around 35, it's just like everybody else. Like, the pain outweighs the fear. Like, I got so sick of myself, and I got so sick of disappointing myself and the people that I loved. I was so lonely. I was so disappointed with how my life had turned out. I just woke up from a wedding one day and, like, couldn't remember how I got home, and it was like the 500th time that it happened to me. It wasn't like,
were you one of those at the wedding?
Yeah. And I was just like,
I was too.
did I do something? Do I need to send the bride an apology? I have no idea.
Maybe you are the bride and you don't even know it, you know?
Exactly. Like, I mean, because with blackouts, like, you could do something like so unbelievably crushingly embarrassing, or you can just, like, leave quietly and go home.
How dangerous? How dangerous are blackouts? Like, what's the long-term effect? Do you know?
Neurologically, no, they don't know. It couldn't be good for you because you're drinking so much. But, I mean, as far as, like what's interesting is that they look like dementia. If you look at dementia in somebody, an older person, that's what blackouts look like. You can't remember things that just happened. So they're sort of, like, inducing dementia in a younger person, which is pretty creepy. But the danger is more in drinking that much, because the kind of blackouts I had tend to happen around 0.2 or 0.25. Is it 0.02? So, like, suddenly I'm not sure about BACs. But anyway, they're not that far from the limit where people start dying of alcohol poisoning. And I also used to fall down the stairs a lot because I wore heels. So, like,
I'm not laughing. Darren, stop laughing. Sorry.
Listen, I get it. I know. That's just my story.
I know.
But that was the biggest danger for me. And then, of course, you know, there's certain therapist. Like, I had a therapist, and she was like, oh, he's so freaked out that somebody was going to, like, take advantage of me in one of these blackouts. And certainly, like, people have written to me since then and been like, how do you know that some cabbie didn't rape you? And I'm like, well, technically I don't. But, I mean, there is an enormous amount of sexual vulnerability that exists when you're going around in a state where you don't remember what happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real thing, and it happens and so forth. There's a line in your, I think this is your bio, but there's just a line I find really powerful, and I absolutely love it. It's about giving up the thing you cherish most, but getting yourself back in return. I read that, and I was just like I personally know I have a thought behind that. So I just wanted to know, what's your concept there? What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was nothing I loved more than alcohol, and I thought that it fixed me, and I thought I needed it to be all the things that I wanted to be, which was funnier, faster, sexier, better. And then I think it wasn't until I let go of it that I got to actually have those things and earn them.
It's the whole concept of surrender. I mean, we hold on so tight to, like, this idea of who we are, what the world is, what people, places, and things are, what everybody thinks about us, what I think about myself. You know, just all that noise. I mean, I'm getting tired just thinking about it. And then the minute you just, like, hey, it's going to be okay, and just, like, give it up, and I surrender. I'm done, you know, okay, whatever. And then next thing you know, like, after, it can be a couple of days, it could be a couple of weeks, it could be a couple of years, depending on your own personal journey, but then you end up getting this life that you just had no idea existed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, it was really a slow change, and I think slow was a difficult process for me because alcohol is real instant gratification. Mm-hmm. And I had to reorient my pleasure system to be a little slower.
How did you do
that?
And
earn that pleasure.
You got any tips on that?
I hated my life for a year. I mean, I just learned to tolerate being unhappy for a while. And you know, I think I was so used to drinking my way out of uncomfortable feelings, but it kept me stuck in uncomfortable feelings.
Because what you're talking about is neuroplasticity, which I would listen to a talk a little while ago, and I really hope the addiction treatment world really starts picking up on neuroplasticity, because it's exactly what you just said. We have to reprogram our mind and rebuild our sensor pleasureships and rebuild everything that made us happy before that ended up getting us into detox. Like, how do we rebuild all that? And it takes, you know, experiences with like-minded people.
It takes
people.
Time.
Yeah, it takes time.
And I think that's why whatever you call, like, hitting bottom, you have to losing hope was what it was for me. Like, I basically lost hope that alcohol could fix me anymore because it stopped working.
So today, and you know, it's 2019 in a couple of weeks. So what's it like now? I mean, you're this reporter and you're a drinker and you're like hanging out, and I don't know if you smoke cigarettes, but you know, you had a cigar hanging out of your mouth through nose. You're having all this stuff blacked out. I would have loved to have had a conversation with you during a blackout. So now what's it like now? You know, sober friends, sober dinners, sober sex, sober everything. What's it like now? Is it better than you thought?
Well, I'll tell you, I really thought I wasn't going to date anybody. And I will say, man, sex is so much better sober.
Perfect.
It is so much better. But here's the thing. It's so much harder to find somebody that you want to do that with. I am so much more selective. It's not even funny. I was so unselective. I was so not selective. And I have such higher standards. And then the experience is, like, so much, I can't even tell you how much better. And I feel like that's pretty much the truth about everything. Like, it's harder to find people that I connect with, but when I do, it's that much deeper. It's harder to find things that are fun, but when I do, they're that much better. I can't just go to the bar and hang out with people. That was, like, the easiest, like paint, you know, paint-by-numbers life. Just go to the bar and hang out.
Yeah.
I can't do that anymore. I have to seek out things that interest me. I have to ask people when I want to hang out with them. I have to, you know, I have to work harder, but then the rewards are so much better. And, you know, I quit smoking when I quit drinking, which is crazy, but it tells you, I just didn't care that much about cigarettes. I loved alcohol so much, and it it just shook me to my core to lose that. And then cigarettes, I was just like, oh, I don't care. But I have really found I think sobriety is, you know, it's not as much fun in a lot of ways, but it's better. It's richer. If all you want is fun, fun is like this super thing, this superficial thing. That's like, I feel like whenever anybody would try to sell me on this idea that sobriety was fun, I would just look at them like they were lying, you know, because like there's no way. If you take a drug that makes you basically think everything, every moment feels good, then you're going to have fun a lot. But this is better because it's truer, and it's not counterfeit. You know, so much of that stuff was counterfeit.
So it's
and then this feels like the real stuff.
It's Christmas party season, and I'm seeing all these memes on Facebook. You know, it's a challenging time for people because of the Christmas party alcohol and, oh, have a drink. Oh, I don't drink.
Yep.
And then, you know, there's that whole conversation meme going on. It's like, why do I have to, like, defend the fact that I don't drink and just carry on and move on? And so what kind of suggestions do you, like, you're going to go to Christmas parties. Obviously, people are drinking. You seem like you've got your self-esteem intact. So what are some of the things you say to people, or what do you give for suggestions to others that feel triggered?
Well, I always bring my own seltzer, Topo Chico or whatever, something to drink for myself, because I gave up thinking, assuming that everybody would have that, and it just makes me feel more comfortable to go in knowing that I've got what I'd like to drink. You know, I don't have to deal with this awkward interchange of, why don't you drink? Or I didn't know that you don't drink, because I wrote a book about it, so everyone kind of knows that about me.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, I do remember, though, when that was so hard, and it really, really bugs me that people want to needle around in your dirt to find out why you don't drink. I just always tell people, just say you're not drinking for right now, or that you're driving home, or whatever. Like, say whatever will make you feel comfortable. Stop worrying about what makes other people feel comfortable.
Yeah,
and I think
say
that's
what makes you
what
feel
I,
comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the point. I like the tip about bring your own thing to drink, because I went to a Christmas party. This is last year, but I still remember it to this day. You know, and it was. Everything was alcohol, and the only beverage they had in the fridge was tonic water. And milk.
Yeah, I know.
And the host knew that I didn't drink, so he's like, would you like a glass of milk? And I'm like, do I want a glass of milk? Like,
Nesquik in there.
I have pretty thick skin. I was completely embarrassed, where I was just like, I'm not going to walk around this room with a glass of milk. You know, and so I forced myself to horribly drink tonic water, which I can't stand, just because I couldn't have a glass of milk. So thanks for being on our show. We really appreciate it. So your website, you know, really quickly, what's your website? You got your book.
Sure, it's just my name. Yeah, it's sarahhepola.com. SARAHHEPOLA.
And you've got an Instagram page, you've got Twitter, you're on Facebook, so you can get the book. The book's on Amazon. The book is called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. So do you also write other blogs as well, or what else is it?
I'm a journalist, so I write other stories. I mean, I write for magazines and newspapers, and
So you can catch all of that on her website. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkrecoveryradio, and there's links to all of Sarah's handles and so forth on her Instagram and so forth. Any other books coming up on the topic alcohol, addiction, recovery?
No, I think that's going to be the one that I write on that subject.
All right, perfect. So if you want to learn more about blackouts, you want to learn about change, you want to learn about recovery, you want to learn about women and drinking, this seems like a great book. Thank you so much for writing your memoir, and thanks for being on Talk Recovery Radio.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Thank you. Darren, what song do we got coming up?
Well, stay tuned. We got Scott H. in the studio sharing his personal story here on Talk Recovery, CFRO 100.5 FM. We're going straight down into some real deep, soulful music here. Little Edwin Starr. This is called Easing In. It's just what it suppresses, eh? That's the relief.
It brought me relief immediately.
Yeah. Like, relief from what? You want to get... Thank you. Back to Talk Recovery, easing in. Man, that is groove. Okay, we're back on Talk Recovery, CFRO 100.5 FM. Our interview with Sarah Heppola at the top of the show. Great little memoir book that she's written there. And then now it's time for personal stories. So tune on in, get onto your Facebook if you're, you know, not driving, obviously. Don't watch us. Just listen. We have Scott H. in the studio with us today. Scott, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming in. I mean, it's authors all over writing memoirs, the whole story. But I think this is a topic or a lifestyle or a subject that a lot of us don't want to say out loud. Right, I feel like we talked about that a bit at the show. You know, the stigma, whatever it is, denial. I mean, it's personal. So, thanks for coming in and sitting down with us. So, let's just get right into it. Tell us a little bit about the past.
Sure. So, my name is Scott, and I'm from Port Coquitlam. I grew up in the Lower Mainland. Came from a really good family. I got two sisters. So I started using probably when I was about like 13 or 14. I got into starting to drink and starting to party on weekends, and I really looked up to people that drank, and I thought it was like really cool. The lady before was talking about blackouts, and I remember a few of my first blackouts. They were not fun, but and just like waking up the next day and saying like I'm never gonna do that again, but in the end, I ended up doing it over and over and over for years, and it just sucked.
You build a reputation sometimes, eh? Like especially earlier on, you know, the pothead, the guy that does the crazy stuff when he's drunk. Did you build an identity for yourself with drugs or alcohol?
Totally. So I went through a few phases. Like when I was in high school, I smoked a lot of weed and I hung out with guys that sold weed, and I was you'd say pothead, and but I also played a lot of sports and stuff, so like I tried to hang out with the popular kids, and so I would drink also, and drinking was one of my big problems also. But as I like my addiction progressed, I found I was using a lot more hard drugs. Like, I started using a lot of ecstasy in high school, started doing coke in high school. And yeah, when I used, I just felt invincible and on top of the world. But I would do crazy shit, and like, people would always find out about it, and I'd be embarrassed when I'd like come out of my blackout. But I remember, like, that was my identity.
Yeah, the party guy.
Yeah, the one that had it going on. But if you wanted to party hard, it was like, call Scott.
Yeah. Now, so getting through high, I mean, hard drugs, soft drugs. Like, we're talking about high school. Yeah. 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's cocaine, ecstasy, marijuana, drinking. You know, like in high school, who knows what's in high schools nowadays? I wouldn't have the faintest, but I'm sure it's not getting, you know, like diminished in quantity or you know, options as far as school goes. So, like, do you think you could have gotten around, you know, the using the drugs, the people? If you look back in hindsight, you know, what could you have done?
I don't think I could have, like, avoided it. It was kind of like my identity, and, like, that's what I did. Like, I lived to party, and that's all I focused on. Like, I lost a lot of my passions. I stopped playing hockey. I stopped snowboarding as much, and I pretty much would just be sick from, like, the day the weekend started till the end. I was on, like, a wild roller coaster where, like, you never know what's going to happen. And then as I got older, it started being, like, during the weekdays, every day. It was, like, just, like, a routine. Like, so I worked up north, too. I went to BCIT when I was 20 years old and joined a trade. And I thought, like, because I have a job and because I'm, like, making good money and I'm successful, that it doesn't matter. Like, how dare you try to tell me that I got a problem.
Yeah, and so that looked like that was just high school fun, people letting loose, coming from a good family, you know, small town Poco. You know, you're not going to end up like the people outside these doors, you know? Like, you're not that bad, right? So, like, obviously, with that mindset, you're not going to really be in control, or nothing's going to persuade you to slow down or to completely stop at this point, right? So, did working out of town get you into more chaos?
Yeah, I found as my addiction progressed and as I was in the trade longer and longer, I met the people that used and drank in camp. And when I lived in remote areas, I would still use just as much as when I was at home. And because I had a lot of time off also when I was home and I had a lot of money, I found, like, it fueled my addiction far greater. I would be home and, like, people would be going to the bar on, say, Friday to Saturday night, and I'd still be going on, like, a Wednesday night.
Yeah,
and
you're not working.
Yeah, and, like, it didn't matter what time of day it was I was using.
So that's a common story in the work out of town, shift work, trade work, you know, heavy duty, getting paid quite a good amount of money. Is that, like, did you see anybody doing anything else other than what you're describing? Did you know of guys clean or a healthy crew of people that, you know, were taking care of themselves?
Totally, yeah. Like, I saw people getting their life together, friends that distanced themselves from me, and getting, like, families and starting and, like, having kids. And even just in my own family, like, my sister had moved away and started a family and, like, was being successful without using drugs and alcohol. And I never thought that was an option for me. When I thought of, like, fun, that was my idea of fun, was getting messed up. And I never thought I was going to stop. I thought, this is my life and this is what I'm going to do until the day I die. So,
you knew you overindulged. You knew you, quote unquote, partied hard. What was the first thing that you recognize that sort of broke that denial where you're like, oh, this is a bit too far?
So, like, when I was 25 years old, I decided to just jump on a plane and go to Mexico by myself for my birthday.
Attaboy.
And, yeah, it was, like, pretty much the whole time there, I was in a blackout, and, like, it's extremely dangerous. Like, yeah. I wasn't thinking, and, like, I was in the country by myself using drugs at an all-inclusive resort, but just with, like, random people, and, like, that was one of my pinnacle moments, like, when I got off the plane and got back to Canada, and I was sick for a little while, and I was like, this is, like, a problem. Like, you're clearly insane. And, like, people would tell me, like, people I was using with were like, dude, you gotta, like, start to go to bed. Like, you stay up for copious amounts of days. You use far too many drugs. Like, you're gonna die.
So these are people that know your behavior, know what you're doing. What about your family? Did they know? What were they commenting on?
My family didn't really catch on to, like, the drugs too much. My little sister actually did, though. She knew the people I was hanging out with and would see me sometimes out and about. And, yeah, my parents didn't really understand what was going on. They thought maybe I just had drank too much. And I kind of, like, hit it pretty good. But the public and, like, my friends knew that I was using drugs, like, pretty big. Most of the people I went to high school with knew I was associated with drugs and stuff, so.
Okay, and so what sort of brought this all to a head? Like, did somebody find out? Did you reach out for help? Did you get in trouble at work? What was the deal?
Yeah, so I kind of hit rock bottom in 2016, and I'd been using for about a week, and then my friends decided, let's go to a strip club, and it was like a Thursday morning, so we decided to cab down to Vancouver. I went to the Number 5 Orange, and we were drinking there for the whole day. And I remember using drugs, and I remember getting kicked out of there. My friends had already left. It was pouring rain, and I was just so depressed, and I gotten beat up. And I reached out. I called my little sister at 5 o'clock, and I was like, hey, like, I need some help. Can you come pick me up? I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, I'm in a sketchy situation, and, like, I don't feel safe. And
so you weren't calling for, like, treatment, help, like... You were called, like, get me out of the downtown.
Yeah, I didn't have a coat, and it was pouring rain, and I was super pissed off that my friends left me, but by the grace of God, it worked out. And when she picked me up, I actually, like, started reaching out and opening up about my issues. She knew I have had a drug problem, and she's like, you need to get help, Scott. Like, you're going to die from this. And her concern was, like, really heartfelt. And even though I was loaded at the time, she reached out to one of my cousins, and she's in recovery, and she told my sister to bring me to a meeting. And
how long ago was this?
This was 2 years ago.
Okay.
So she brings me to this meeting, and I'm completely loaded, blacked out, and there's probably about 250 people at this meeting in New West, and everybody loves me in there, and, like, nobody judges me. And I run into an old friend in the meeting, and I'm shocked. I'm like, what is he doing here? And he says, yeah, I got, like, 60 days clean, and I'm at the safe place up the road. Life is actually really good. And that's, like, one of the main things I remember from that meeting. And I was just, like, a huge influential time in my recovery.
So you were saying, just before we came on air, like, you did a bunch of dope before going into the meeting. So we're talking about a guy that's, you know, crashing from the previous days, beat up, cold, soaking wet, yada yada yada, you know, knows your own sister is, like, really concerned about you. So you agree to go to a meeting, you're high. Like, what was, like, how did you voluntarily get there? Like,
kind of tricked almost.
Okay.
So I was like, I'll agree to talk to to my cousin. If we go to, like, a Tim Hortons and meet up and talk, maybe she'll have some advice or some suggestions.
Okay, I'll listen to one person.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she says, bring him to Winners. And I'm like,
wow.
This, like, a department store? Like, I don't want to meet at a department store. Like, this is not the place to be meeting. So my sister's like, just shut up, and takes me to this meeting.
Winners.
And we arrive at a church, and I'm like, what is this? Like, what's going on?
Why didn't you not run?
I think I was just beaten and broken enough that I was ready. And through going into that meeting, I heard a lot of good things. People said, like, you can get a different way of life from this, and, like, you can change. And if you want help, we're here.
So you actually heard that in your state of mind in, I mean, you must have felt completely uncomfortable with 250 people thinking they're all staring at you. Like, I mean, this, you're describing what I know a lot of people went through, the old trick dropped off, like, you know, a meeting's going to save your life kind of thing. But really, it becomes a nightmare environment, especially somebody that's still high.
Well, it's actually funny. Like, during the meeting, I blirted out probably, like, three times. Like, so there's a guy sharing on step one, and then in the middle of his share, I just, like, stand up and, like, start yelling. I'm like, I want another hug. I want another hug. And I, like, storm up to the front of this meeting, and he's sharing at a podium, and I get another hug from this guy. And, like, I'm fist-pumping my white fob. I don't know. At that moment, I think I was blacked out, but I was also
ready. You were at a party.
I was ready to, like, let's do this.
Yeah, yeah. You were at a party with like 250 people thinking you're the best, you're the most important people, because that's the fact. You were the most important person there
that night, yeah.
Right? Because everybody, oh, this guy needs to be here. This guy needs some help. So, I mean, that's interesting. Very contradictory to my first experience, where it was like staring at the floor, like not wanting it, and just hating the guy that brought me to a meeting where people like talked at me and pointed at me and told me welcome, like, just I hated him for that, right? I just wanted to sit and just like listen if I could, but I didn't want anybody like actually noticing me. So it might have helped, eh, that you were a little under the influence in that situation. What was it like running into somebody? How important was it to have known somebody there from your past?
That was a huge thing, because seeing that I drank with this person before in the past, and like seeing that the lights were on inside his eyes, he was actually sober and present, he was happy, he had friends there, and he seemed confident that this was going to work.
Yeah.
And it was just a huge eye-opener that if he can do this, maybe I can do this too.
And that's, you know, coming back to the top of the show, like, how important is it when somebody says, like, yeah, I'm so-and-so, I'm an addict. It's just like, oh, you are. So it just immediately, we're locked in, listening and hoping that this guy's going to say something relatable, right? But if you already know someone and you've seen their past and you've seen that, there's proof. Like, that's proof that it could be different. So that changed, you became willing to go seek more help?
Yeah, so the next day my sister woke me up, and it was like 6 a.m. and she dragged me to another meeting. And that meeting I did have my head down and I had my hood on and my sunglasses on, and yeah, it was a different feeling. It wasn't such a euphoric high, but I think that's when I was ready to surrender. And I got a suggestion to maybe go to treatment, and that is part of my story. So I followed some of the guys back up to the safe house up the road, and I got introduced to a safe place, and I made a decision that, yeah, like, this is what I need to do, and I am going to die if I keep using this way. And so I decided that day I'm going to change my life and
so you stayed.
And maybe start listening to some people.
How long did you stay in treatment?
So I stayed in treatment at the last door for 4 months.
What was the most important thing that you learned in that 4 months, or the most important realization for you?
The world does not revolve around you.
get out of the middle of the universe. It's too crowded.
Just that, like, caring about somebody else can change your life, and learning a new way of life was a whole new thing. Like, I had to make all new friends. I couldn't hang out with the people I used to hang out with. I couldn't associate with them. And I had to start living with spiritual principles in my life.
And it's not like those were foreign to you. You were raised it with some value. You know what I mean? And you sort of get in touch with what your potential, your true potential is, not under the influence. And that's true. People say you got to change one thing and that's everything. And it's just kind of like, okay, that means job, friends, relationships. Like, you kept your career.
Yeah, I kept my career. So a lot of people told me, like, you're not going to stay clean if you go up north. And I work in, like, remote areas like Fort McMurray, and I work in the oil and gas industry. And yeah, like, certain times of the year I'm gone for a few months, and I'll be staying in, like, remote camps where people do drink and use. But knowing today that I have tools that this the program of NA has taught me is huge. Like, I go to meetings up there.
So there are meetings.
There is meetings. There's lots of meetings.
There's other guys in that are clean and
yeah, I make connections up there also, and I phone people and I talk about what's going on.
Yeah. And, you know, you say that other people are doing what you did in your past. Like, do you just sort of accept that, like, I don't have to be involved in that? Like, I can just go back to my room, read a book?
Yeah, and, like, it's just nice knowing that I don't have to wake up sick. Like, doing my job, I was working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day when I was in these camps and working at these refineries. And it was, like, day in and day out, I would just wake up so sick. And you have to go into work. If you miss, like, a few shifts, you're done. So it was that was my lifestyle. And today it's like my employers are so much happier. They're giving me more responsibility. I'm a far better tradesman.
No doubt.
And I'm a great family member to, like, my sisters. Like, today I'm present in my older sister's life, and she lives in Germany, but I get to FaceTime with my nephew, like, all the time. And I'm going to be going over and visiting her in Germany. And that wasn't a thing in my life when I was using. Like, me and my older sister never talked.
Yeah. So you're back in control.
Yeah.
You can have any goal that you want to achieve. You can plan anything you want in the future because you're in control of your life. If you want it, go get it, right?
Yeah, like, I got to travel last year in February with just over a year clean. We went to Mexico with a few guys I went to treatment with.
Oh, not by yourself.
Not by myself. And it was actually amazing, like, getting to, like, actually see the country and remember things, enjoy the food, go to meetings there, meet people, just, like, actually be in the present state and being able to travel and know that I can stay clean.
So what's, since getting clean and sober and, like, what's changed as in a negative way? Like, what's not fun anymore to do? Like, anything?
Yeah, like, life isn't just all, like, up and like, super great. But sometimes, like, yeah, like, you wake up and it's pouring rain. You got to go out there and work, and you got to do your job. And you got to remember, like, the day's going to get over, and there's going to be good days coming, so.
No doubt. There's going to be good days coming. Scott, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story. Any last words, like, you know, that you want to share to listeners and people that are watching?
Sure. To anybody that's, like, struggling out there right now or, like, on the fence about if they should do this and recovery is, like, an option, just reach out. Like, do what I did. Reach out and ask for help. Go to some meetings and give this a chance. It's changed my life. I'm actually truly happy. I haven't used in 2 years. It's, like, amazing. And you can get this, too.
Love it. Love it. Scott H. in studio on Talk Recovery at Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM. Again, I say it every week how important it is and how courageous, you know, to come in and share your story and you know, get personal and talk about the things that, you know, perhaps your family was ashamed of and concerned about. And, you know, it's not everybody has the family that knows what to do or has connections. Like, you know, like, how fortunate was it that your sister had that contact in that, you know, in that moment and was willing to come down and pick you up and take you home. You know, not everybody has that chance and that opportunity. So, yeah, just another great story. 2 years clean. Scott H., everybody, thanks for watching. Thanks for tuning in. We got a show next week. Okay, well, we'll be live in the studio again. Actually, it doesn't fall on any holiday days No. We're going to be live all through the month of December.
Yes, we are.
How lucky are you guys?
And what's everyone doing on New Year's?
You rejuvenate New Year's Eve.
Exactly. Come on, plug.
There's 20% of tickets left.
For the dinner, yeah.
For the dinner?
Yeah. Okay. Fun and recovery.
Yeah, fun and
You're
recovery.
Going?
I will be there.
Scott's going. Yes, he is. Somebody needs to dance with Scott. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see you next week. Okay, we're going to leave off with a little Canadian folk artist. Please enjoy. This is Steve Broccoli, Socks and Shoes.